Welcome to What Are You Reading? A podcast dedicated to leadership development through a commitment to reading.
This is your host, Eugene Yang. This week, we're joined by Major General John Ferrari, United States Army, retired. Major General John Ferrari is a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. He is also the Chief Administrative Officer at Complex, a data analytics and cybersecurity firm. He served over 32 years in the U.S. Army, including assignments as the Director of Program Analysis and Evaluation, the Command General of the White Sands Missile Range, Deputy Commander for Programs at the NATO Training Mission in Afghanistan, a Strategic Planner for Combined Joint Task Force 7 in Iraq during Operation Iraqi Freedom, and the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment in Desert Storm. He has a Master of Business Administration from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, a Master's in National Resource Strategy and Policy from the Eisenhower School for National Security and Resource Strategy, and a Bachelor's in Computer Science from the United States Military Academy at West Point. Sir, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for what you're doing. This is a great podcast for people to learn from, and I appreciate you taking the time to have me on as a guest.
Thank you, sir. First question for you, what are you currently reading?
Yeah, so like a lot of people, right, I'd like to say I just have one book sitting there, but I'm kind of stacked up with three books right now, and there's kind of a common thread between the three of them. So the first is I'm reading Walter Isaacson's book about Einstein, and what's compelling about that, and I'm almost all the way through, but, you know, Walter Isaacson, everything he writes is really long, so it takes a long time to get through, but what I learned and what's interesting is, you know, Einstein essentially spent his life on the fringes of ideas. And when the scientific community came around to thinking like him, he went to the fringe again. And so he had the courage to kind of be out there on his own, trying to push knowledge and ideas, not knowing whether he was right or wrong. The second book is a book by Bruce Cleveland, who's a venture capitalist, and it's called The Traction Gap. And it's about really how you turn ideas into reality, right? So whereas Einstein had ideas, he really didn't worry too much about kind of at the application of the science, right? Traction Gap says, hey, you know, ideas are okay, but you have to turn them into reality. And while the book, The Traction Gap, is focused on the commercial sector, it really has big applications inside DoD and acquisition and how we either succeed or don't succeed. And the theory behind the book is about getting users involved very early, because whatever you think your idea is, when it hits reality, it's going to change. And then the last book, which I'm just about done with, is AI Superpowers by Keifu Lee. You know, it's about what's going on now with all this technology between the U.S. and China, really. It focuses on the two superpowers developing these tremendous capabilities. And so there is a competition. And really, if you boil the book down to its essence, it's there's a competition and not everybody's playing by the same rules. And so you have to be very careful in what you're doing and understanding the strategic environment that's developing around artificial intelligence. So you have one book on ideas, one book about turning ideas into reality, and then the other book about, hey, you know, you're not alone, right? There are other people out there doing it. You better make sure you understand the rules you're playing by.
Right. Can you talk a little bit more about the traction gap? I'm curious what your thoughts are in getting users involved early. What does that mean for DoD in terms of acquisitions?
Yeah, so the way the traditional DoD process goes is that, you know, somebody comes up with an idea, a warfighter comes up with a requirement, and then they throw it over the transom, they get some money, they get some resources, they spend 10 years, 5 years, whatever, and then they pop out the other end and they say, here it is, it, you know, meets all these requirements. The fallacy in that entire process is that the requirements were right. And it's not that the people who came up with the requirements didn't know what they were doing or they were not doing anything evil, but it's like anybody starting an idea for a company today, right? The best ideas may not be right when they hit reality. So for DoD, really, it's about closing that traction gap. It's getting soldiers involved, the actual end users involved in all steps of that. So you have an idea, we'll go test it with the users, right? You start building it, we'll test it with the users, right? So a bad example of this was, you know, when the Army spent a couple of years developing a new radio, and then when they went out and fielded it, the soldiers put it in their backpack, it's too heavy, it gets too hot, it burns the bottom of a rucksack, and everybody said, well, I built it to the requirement, right? Well, okay, but, you know, the requirement wasn't right. On the flip side, more recently, the Army's IVAS system, which is the Army's virtual reality goggles for the infantry soldier, which is a partnership between Microsoft and the Army, was born without a single requirements document, and it put Microsoft's gaming technology and software developers next to soldiers, and they said, you all figure out what's possible and how to do it. And it's really moving along at record speed. And so what you have is, you know, a company that wasn't used to doing business, Microsoft, with DoD, actually, you know, bringing in and insisting that if they were going to do this, right, they just wanted to talk to the user. Everybody else was interesting, but relatively unimportant. And so, you know, the traction gap is really about that, which is, right, so how do you overcome that gap of a good idea actually hitting traction? And, you know, there have been other books written, The Killer App, and The Traction Gap is a bit more, it's a newer book and really, you know, aimed at startups, but really has a lot of lessons in it for big established bureaucracies.
What do you think are the costs associated with? So if you have end users working, you know, hand in hand with Microsoft in that example, and they're not maybe doing their job or what they would be doing, what is the opportunity cost there? Or maybe what's the institutional resistance to having more of those kind of relationships?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because the Army runs around with this all the time and says, well, it's getting in the way of my training, and so I don't have time to do it. But the question is, right, you don't have time to do it, what's the cost of not doing it when you have weapon systems or systems that don't actually work?
Right.
There's the old saying, right, if you didn't have time to do it right the first time, right, how are you going to have time to do it right two or three times over and over? So we wind up wasting more time with weapon systems that don't work. And so you can still get a lot of training value out when they're working it, right? Because, right, what you're doing is you're putting the squad in this case, right, because it's an individual soldier with the programmers, and they're like, hey, I'm going in, right, I'm doing a mount training site, and we're going to take down this building. So they can train while they're doing that. And then they say, hey, this didn't work very well. And what you get are these iterative learning cycles of people figuring out, the soldiers, how to use this technology and change the way they do business, right? So this is a two-sided coin, because a lot of people think that you should build a technology to do the way you fight. The other way is change the way you fight based upon the technology. And the same thing in the commercial world, where established companies are trying to do what they've always been doing, but just use technology. Startups in the United States disrupt the environment because they actually relook at how business is done and use the technology to change the way business is done. And that's one of the reasons, you know, in the commercial sector, large organizations fail over time, right? Because they fail to make that adaptation. The challenge with the military and with all militaries and governments is that you only meet that failure when you meet the enemy, because we don't allow this creative destruction, you know, in economic term, to redo how things are done, right? They're top-down driven, and you don't allow, for example, the 82nd Airborne Division to innovate on its own and come up with a way and then displace the 101st Air, you know, Air Assault, right? Because it knows how to fight better, right? That doesn't happen, right? Because it's a controlled environment versus the capitalist system, which says, you know, the best idea wins.
Right. So I want to shift topics a little bit and ask, over your career, what professional development was maybe the most critical in shaping your leadership style?
So I think there's two parts to that answer, right? So the first part is that there's two ways to learn, and that I learned early, right? You can learn from your own experiences, and that can be very, very painful, or you can learn from other people's experiences. The only way to really learn from other people's experiences is to read. And so early on, you know, when I went to West Point, I didn't really know anything. I didn't come from a military background. My family, first in the military, first to go to college. So I did a lot of reading at West Point just about the Army, because I had really no idea what it was, right? Which is strange to say for somebody who went to West Point, right? So I probably didn't do my homework as well as I should have, right? But I learned to read, you know, novels and things about how the army was and what it did, and learn from that, so you understand how the bureaucracy that you're joining and how the organization works. Mm-hmm. The second thing to more directly answer your question is, right, that I think the job, the specific experience that I had that taught me was also at West Point. My senior year, I was chosen to be the brigade operations officer, which is responsible for kind of coordinating and synchronizing all the activities across the Corps of Cadets. And what that really taught me was that if you want to do anything, doesn't matter how small or how big, it takes a myriad of people to do it, and none of them actually report to you, work for you. And they all have their own inboxes and outboxes, and what you think is important may not be what they think is important. And so it taught me early that, you know, you're in one respect, you're in the military, mm-hmm. and it's top down, yes, left, right, left, yes, sir, no excuse, sir, I do not understand your four responses, right?
Right.
And so you kind of grow up in that environment thinking you just tell people what to do and they do it, right? That's what West Point, right? But what that job taught me there was, wow, that's not actually how the world operates. It's really about indirect leadership. So then the question is always, right, well, how do you learn those indirect leadership skills? And throughout my career, really, I had less direct leadership opportunity and much more indirect opportunities. And it's inverse, right? When you join the Army, you're a platoon leader and it's more direct leadership. You get 15, 20, 30 people and, you know, you kind of tell them what to do. You show up formation at 6 o'clock, they show up. And when you're a general, right, almost nobody works for you and it's almost entirely indirect leadership. And interesting enough, warfare is almost all indirect leadership because while you have a number of organizations that may or may not work for you, right? Most of them don't. When, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq, right? There were coalitions. And then you had all the State Department and you had NGOs and you had the host nation countries, the Afghans or the Iraqis, and all of them had to be brought together, right? And so really leadership and operations are about bringing teams of teams together.
Right. Do you think we have too much of a focus either in how we think or how we talk when it comes to direct leadership, telling people what to do, tasks, operations, orders, things of that nature?
Absolutely. Yeah, right. But that's our culture and our hierarchy, right? So then the question is, right, so how do you overcome that, right? And that's when you read and you work different things. And so, you know, the book that really kind of pulled it all together for me is Robert Caro's multi-volume dissertation on the Lyndon Johnson years, right? So Lyndon Johnson, when you think of him, one of the most influential people in the last century in the United States, right? And it was all about indirect leadership and the exercise of power. And what's interesting is people, you know, because he was a congressman and a senator, but even and then a vice president, right? And the vice president isn't in charge of much. But even as president, when you read that volume of Lyndon Johnson as the president, and everybody thinks, wow, the president's got all this power.
Right.
It was all about, and his entire career was focused on, how do you bring together people who don't want to do something to do something. And, you know, you look at the legislation that he got passed and the change that he had affected on this country. It was all about indirect leadership and power. Some of it positives, a lot of it negative, right? So there's positive leadership and negative leadership. And he could both praise and reward and punish. He was an expert at exerting that. And so that's a great example of, right, wow, okay, right. How do you go about doing that and building coalitions and leading indirectly?
Do you have any examples of getting together these teams that maybe don't want to do what you want them to do, or they have different priorities? How do you get them to align with your priorities or get a win-win situation? Do you have any examples you could share with us of how you've done that effectively before?
Yeah. So I'll leave others to judge effectively, right? I'll just tell you, right. I'll give you an example. My time in Afghanistan, I spent 18 months in Afghanistan in a NATO training mission, Afghanistan, and which was the arm of the NATO and the U.S. effort to train and equip the Afghan army and police. And it was at the time General McChrystal had just gone in. And so it was the surge in Afghanistan. And the plan was you surge the U.S. forces, allow time to build up the Afghan security forces, and then you can move the U.S. forces out and the Afghans take over. And the Congress of the United States had just given the organization that I was in, you know, essentially was taking it from $1 billion a year to $11 billion a year in order to do that. So it was a large influx of money, resources, and priority. And so you get there and think, okay, it's going to be the main effort. We're going to build. We're going to say what needs to be done. And it's the Army, right? Everything's going to move out. Well, it turns out that, you know, so the warfighters, the U.S. warfighters wanted to use, right, the IJC, the Joint Command, the Operational Command of the Warfight. They needed the Afghan forces now to fight and beat back the Taliban. So there was this constant tension of, right, do you train them and husband them so that they can be more ready at the back end, or do you consume the forces, build them, consume them, and then try to rebuild it, but that slows down your build effort. Then you had the Afghans, right? And then you're right, the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of the Interior and the political process that had to play out and the competing factions of what they thought the visions were for their war fights. You had the U.S. State Department, which traditionally oversees police training. And then the notion is, well, what is police training and how are you training the police? Because policing and army functions are very different. But that's a hard line to figure out in the middle of a insurgency where the police are the target. So you had to work through that. And then you had non-governmental organizations who, for rule of law and anti-corruption, who were all out there and right and watching this. And then you had all the NATO coalition members who were doing the training, the gendarmerie, right, and Italians, and they had certain ways of doing things. And it wasn't that it was right or wrong, right? They were just, some of them were different, and you had to bring that all together and really unify the whole thing around a concept and an idea and be less concerned about how people got things done and more concerned about the outcome. And so oftentimes, right, you'd look at it and go, well, I wouldn't have done it that way. Mm-hmm. That actually didn't matter because you weren't actually doing it. Now, the challenge for us on the U.S. side was the Congress of the U.S. was writing the checks. In my view, that was like the key linchpin of the whole operation, because in Iraq, right, I had learned from Iraq where when the Congress of the United States felt that the money that it was putting in was not being safeguarded and put appropriately to use, they just cut the money off. Right now, the Iraqis could keep going because they had oil money, but in Afghanistan, they didn't. So if we didn't follow the rules and the expectations of the Congress, and they cut off the money, there was no Iraq, there was no Afghan army and police anymore. And so part of the discussions with everybody was, hey, there are certain ways things have to be done, because if they're not, right, the money goes away. And if the money goes away, so goes the Afghan army and police. It was existential. And so in a lot of ways, that idea and the forcing function of the U.S. Congress enabled that operation to really come together to build out the Afghan army and police.
Awesome. That sounds like a very complicated stakeholder analysis. A lot of very different people, very different functions, and what they're trying to achieve.
And then stakeholders change over time. So just because the person you're working with, the State Department, believes one thing today, when they turn over, right, somebody else may think something different. And the same thing on our side, right? The military had high turnover also. So you had this constant need to align stakeholders because the war was really being fought in these 6 month increments of people and units and organizations. And the only people there for the long term were the Afghans, right? And so in a lot of, and they would kind of, you know, look at you and go, hey, you know, the guy three before you tried this and it didn't work then. Why do you think it'll work? And you go, okay, right. So listening becomes a very, very, very important skill set the more senior you become.
Right. Sir, I'm curious, you've served as the Director of Program Analysis and Evaluation. For our audience out there without knowledge or experience in DOD, can you explain what role that job plays in the Army and what you did when you were there?
It is a uniquely Department of Defense role. And so, right, most people won't understand what it is. But the role was put in place in the 1960s by Robert McNamara, who wanted to bring more analytics into the resource and strategic decision-making of the Department of Defense. The Army's part of that is Army Program Analysis Evaluation, and I was in it as a major, and then again, I had the privilege to lead that organization my last 6 years in the Army. And I used to tell people that my job in the Army as the PA&E was to make everybody a little bit unhappy, right? Because if everybody was unhappy, then the Army as a whole could optimize its resource and decision-making. Because generally, when people have these programs and are seeking resources, they all want to do the best that program can be, right? So nobody comes in and goes, you know, I'm going to develop a mediocre program, right?
I hope not, yeah.
But the problem is the Army's a big organization. It's got lots of needs and wants. And so in order to optimize the Army, you have to sub-optimize everything underneath it. And so that was kind of my job. And that was one part of the job. The other part, which I think is also very important, is, right, so as the Army's going through deciding during booms and bust cycles of resourcing, right, it's being able to spot the mega trend that's going on and that you happen to be involved in. And then understanding that if you understand the mega trend, then you understand how to ride the wave. because you can expend a lot of energy and effort and eventually drown if you try to swim against the current. And if you think about it, the really two good books that kind of set my mindset and all of that. The first is The Singularity Is Near by Ray Kurzweil. And Ray wrote it, you know, I guess, 2005 or so. But his point was, my big takeaway from that is, people are programmed to think linearly. So they kind of take what just happened and they just linearly move it out and draw a straight line. But actually, and especially now, right, things are changing exponentially. And if you're doing linear decision making, and especially in the programming range and the Defense Department, looking out 5, 10, 15 years, and you're thinking linearly, and the world is changing and technology is changing exponentially, you're not going to be off by a little bit. You're going to be off by a lot, right? So part of the job was understanding and trying to shape and getting others to think about that. The other book is, a bit different, right? So while Kurzweil is kind of the crazy genius, right? Tom Friedman's book, Thank for Being Late, right? And you know, he's kind of the pundit, right? He's able to look at things and very clearly articulate what's going on. And, you know, his point was that there are these times in history where things come together and the world changes. And his book in 2007 really was about the bringing together of the emergence of cloud computing, cellular technology, and handhelds. And that those three technologies that came together have fundamentally, in ways that nobody can anticipate, changed the entire world, right? Facebook wouldn't be possible, right? Disinformation, right? All the things we're doing, this podcast we're doing would not be possible without that. And if you miss the trend or you don't understand it, then you're not going to survive. You're going to be left in the dustbin of history. And so he kind of, through case studies, goes through organizations that have either exploited the trend or missed it. And so in the Army, it's how do we prevent the Army in this competition, this global competition? How do you not lose the next war because you missed the trend? And it's hard because decision-making in the Department of Defense, the decision-makers are disconnected in many ways from the outcome and risk of their decision. So if you own a company and you make bad decisions and the company goes bankrupt, you lose the wealth you put in. But in the Army, with decision spaces in the Department of Defense being so long, right, that the senior decision makers are not the ones that will be at the first battle of the next war. They are the 18-year-old young men and women that today are freshmen and sophomores in high school, worrying about COVID and right grades and all those things that kids in high school worry about. But as we sit here and decisions are being made in DOD, right, their future is being shaped. And the people making those decisions aren't going to be the ones on the first battle of the next war. It's going to be those young kids. And you've always got to remember that feedback mechanism that things rely on is missing. And so as the PA&E, it was always this constant, right, hey, here are the trends. And here's if these decisions, hey, look at these young kids, right, this is the impact of that. And when you say, well, we'll take risk here to do this, it's bringing it home and going, well, okay, do we understand what the definition of risk is and who's actually bearing that risk? And, you know, so Friedman's book and Kurzweil's book were instrumental in kind of having me kind of, you know, think on the outside and kind of get the organization to kind of also adapt some of that thinking.
As we get farther and farther away from, you know, where the costs are being borne, what do we need to do as leaders to get that good feedback loop? What kind of people do we need to empower? What kind of processes do we need to use to get that feedback so we can understand how to make good decisions there?
Yeah, so part of it is, right, there has to be a willingness for leaders to go, I don't know. And so you have to be both intellectually humble and intellectually curious to do that. And there's a good book about the Ford Motor Company, about making it, right, the greatness, the American Icon, I think it's called. And Bill Ford, the family, right, took over the company, and he realized that he, as the leader of that company, didn't have the skill sets to transform the company. And he brought in an executive from Boeing to do that. So in the military, if we understand these profound changes that are going on, and we think about and we use examples that aren't necessarily us, but are adjacent to us enough that you can learn without kind of poking the organization, right? I think of Sears and Amazon. When you think about it, right, Sears in the 1960s, you could call them up and order a house essentially online, telecommunicate, and they would deliver you a house and you could assemble it. Here in Northern Virginia, there are Sears houses. Even Amazon today can't really do that. So if you think about it, 50 years ago, here's this organization called Sears that you could order almost anything out of its catalog, even a house, and they would send it. Well, how is it today that Sears is bankrupt and Amazon is worth $2 trillion or whatever, you know, trillion and a half, right? And when you think about it, right, Sears had better access to capital than Amazon had, right? It had facilities and infrastructure and all the same people. Both leadership teams had all the same ingredients. The Sears leadership team could not, because they grew up in the retail store, they could not accept that, hey, you know, you got to hire these web developers. And you know, these web developers might actually make more money than your store managers. Well, that's not our culture, right? Our culture is, right? And so they would spend a lot of time trying to figure out, well, do I move the lawnmowers from aisle 14 to aisle 16? But you got Jeff Bezos over there hiring all these smart programmers and all, right, saying, hey, listen, why don't I take the store that Sears has, instead of having people come to it, I'll just have the lawnmower and I'll just ship it to the people, right? So it's not about moving it from, right, it's completely reinventing the model of that store. But the Sears leadership grew up in that store and couldn't understand that if you gutted it, just stored stuff, used robots moving around and moved it to the individual, that the world would change. And so within the military, it's the same thing, right? So how do you convince the people that have grown up fighting in a certain way, right, to change? And you can go back in history and the early 1900s with air power, right? And tanks, right? Where people thought, hey, this metal's good. I'll just put the metal on the horses. And now I can, you know, I can charge with the horses. It's like, ooh, dude, right? Those machine guns that's not going to work too well. And so the Germans figured out how to do that, right? The mechanized units, and they just, you know, beat the French, right? The French put the Maginot Line up, and they're just like, dude, I'll just drive around it. So now we've got a similar revolution going on with artificial intelligence and networks and cloud computing and sensors to shooters. And so how does that change, right, how we fight? And that's a fundamental question. And if we approach the decision-making like Sears did, which is, so how do I take all of this technology and make the retail experience in the store better, right? So Sears would say, okay, take all that stuff and tell me how this is how I want to sell, make the technology make that work. As opposed to, hey, here's the technology, how do I sell differently? So within the military, you've got to be very careful that the people making the decisions aren't trying to use the technology to fight the way they want to fight, and instead are inverting it and saying, how can the technology enable me to change the way we fight? We saw that in Iraq in 2004, right? So the insurgents took cell phones and car batteries and, you know, doorbell openers and, right, explosives and, you know, really changed the nature of insurgency warfare that the U.S. was completely and utterly unprepared for with the roadside bomb. We eventually adapted, right, because, right, lives were dependent upon it. But we couldn't envision doing that. But these scrappy insurgents, right, kind of took what they did and innovated with it.
That's a really interesting example. I want to ask a little bit about your time as a talent manager for ORSAs in the Army. First, can you also explain a little bit what ORSAs are for folks that aren't familiar? And then if I remember correctly, you provided a reading list to the ORSA community. Can you tell us a little bit about that as well and how you shaped the education development piece for that community?
Yeah, thanks. And so the ORSAs are a career field in the Army, and ORSA stands for, because it's the military, so you got to have an acronym, right? So it's Operations Research Systems Analysts. So think of them as mathematicians. The core competency of a ORSA is math. It goes back to, right, and if you think about math, right, in World War II, the Battle of Atlantic, and computers come from compute, which really came from the firing tables and things in World War II. So the ORSAs were really, you know, at the turn, you know, in World War II, trying to predict and use mathematics to predict what the Germans were doing and to break codes. In the 1960s, Robert McNamara brought them into with his whiz kids, right? So the descendants of those horses applied those techniques to management in the commercial sector in the U.S. And then he applied them to management within the Department of Defense. And so within the military, I always used to say, well, we're military horses, right? So we're not just regular horses, because we apply the tools of mathematics to military problems, both institutional and operational, either in the war fight where, okay, if you've got so many helicopters and you're in Iraq, right, where do you put your helicopter evacuation points so the 1 hour golden hour, right, of treating somebody works? Well, that's an ORSA problem, right? It's a mathematical problem. So as the PA&E, right, the program analysis evaluation, right, the PA&E director was dual-hatted, not just as the PA&E, but also as the talent manager for the Army's 600 to 800 uniformed military forces. And that include recruiting them in from the force, right? Because as a functional area, right, you took young captains who had already done their basic branch and then brought them in. And then you trained and educated them and managed their life cycles and assignment patterns. And what I would always emphasize to them was, your math and your computer skills are kind of your credentials. They get you in the door. But what you really need to do is to be able to think creatively and understand the organization in which you are operating. And so I put out a reading list early on, and somebody said, well, there's no math books, right? Where's this book and that book? And my point was, listen, right, it's a given, right? If you're not good at math and decision making and all that stuff, right, you wouldn't be here. But it's all about helping people make decisions. And so some of the interesting things on the reading list that I put was, Brian Grazer wrote a book called The Curious Mind. And Brian teamed with Ron Howard, right? So Ron Howard, Opie, right? They run Imagine Entertainment. And so they are big in the movie industry. But the book is about curiosity. And Brian talks about, right, because when you think about it, if somebody uses the word and I go, well, that's curious. Right? It's kind of got a little negative connotation to it. And it's really about saying no, right? You need to be curious. And how do you be curious? And how do you go talk to people? And how do you open up your mind and just go pull the thread on something because it's interesting? And so, ORSAs tend to be, mathematicians tend to be rule-based, right? And then you take a military officer and you put him in a rules-based society in a hierarchical organization. And well, you get it, right? All of a sudden you get people who are very rules-based. And my point to them was over and over, stop. You have to be curious, right? You have to pull it. You have to exploit things. But you also have to understand the environment, right? So if you're an ORSA and you're working in Iraq or Afghanistan and you're working on counterinsurgency policy, you better understand counterinsurgency, right? So you need to read a book like Alistair Horne's A Savage War and Peace. Right. Because that's where Alistair Horne, a Brit, wrote about the French in Algier, the civil war that was the insurgency in the 1960s. Because you can do all the analytics you want about insurgency, but if you don't understand insurgencies, right, the analytics are going to be worthless. There's this domain expertise that analysts have to have. And so when you look at my reading list, it was an eclectic mix of curiosity, kind of the Lean Startup by Eric Ries, which is how do you be innovative within a large organization, but then everything from A Savage War and Peace to the idea of Pakistan, right? Because in thinking about how these problems are, because if you get and it goes back to understand the macro trend before you try to define the micro answer. And so my reading list to them was really about opening up their apertures of the bureaucracy they worked in, curiosity, and then the domains they would be operating in. And it's hard to do by experience because any one person is only going to have an experience. And so part of that was, okay, read what other people have said and done and understand, and then you can draw your own conclusion.
Right. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense in having the domain information inform then how do we do analysis, and without that, numbers are just numbers. So I am curious, so you graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Computer Science from West Point, And then when Emelian became a cavalry officer and then switched over and spent time as a strategist and programmer, now you're working at a data analytics and cybersecurity firm. I'm curious, why did you choose computer science in undergrad to start with? And then after doing that kind of work, how come you didn't want to do a field like communications or signals intelligence?
So I caught the computer science bug in high school, and I guess I was very lucky, right? So I was in high school from 79 to 83, which to a lot of people wonder, right, were there even computers back then? And, right, there were punch cards and mainframes, and you had to reserve time. And I really liked the kind of the structured thinking of computer science, but also the innovative way of coding and solving problems, right? So my specialty was always kind of the software side of computer science. I never liked the hardware side of it, right? The hardware side, the electrical engineering was much more rules-based. And the software side allows for creativity. And if you look at a lot of the hackers and a lot of the, right, it's like an art, right? So it's this blend of artistry and science, because the code's only going to do what the code does, no matter what you want. But there are creative ways to get it to live and dance. And so I wanted to study that, right? And so, you know, I was able to do that at West Point, right? So I applied to college knowing that I wanted to study computer science. So then your question is, right, so, okay, so why didn't you do that coming out, you know, of West Point, right? Because back then, computers and programming, there wasn't a big career field or way to do that out of West Point, right? When you come out of West Point, you're going to be a platoon leader, right? So unlike today, where you can branch into cyber or, right, the Signal Corps is doing all that stuff, that option was not available. So the next best thing is becoming a cavalry officer, because cavalry officers in the 2nd Cavalry and the 3rd Cavalry, you operate in front of the formation with minimal instruction and supervision, and you go out, find the enemy, figure out what they're doing, and do something about it. And so it provided this great blend of that assignment, right, that I had learned about and other people had taken, you know, and talking to them, really kind of played to that artistry and flair, right, within, not bound by rules, right? Cavalrymen kind of go out there, they're dashing, they ride around, and right. So that's that kind of theme. That's what attracted me to that. Then your question was, well, you know, OK, so what changed after that? Well, after, right, the drawdown of the 90s hit, and really the cavalry formations were, for the most part, shut down. And then I wound up teaching economics at West Point, and I got an MBA to learn the business side. Right. Because as I was looking at graduate school, I knew computer science, but I was more interested, well, how do you take that stuff and then apply it and build something from it? And so I got an MBA. And then from that, at West Point, wound up in the Office of Economic and Manpower Analysis, which is a consulting arm in the basement of the economics department, which essentially did data science before data science was cool. Right. So I was doing data science when, if you said you did it, people kind of said, okay, I'm not inviting you to a party. Right? So today they're rock stars, right? But back then, right, you weren't. And that's where I really learned about being an ORSA. And I was able to bring mathematics, computers, and problem solving together and really enjoyed doing that, and kind of then made my second half of my career all about that in the Army. And so that had a profound impact, that assignment, as in the organization called OEMA, the Office of Economic and Manpower Analysis, really opened my eyes to big data. And once again, that was before big data even existed, and then enabled me to kind of help, you know, the Army kind of move through that.
Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you're currently doing at Complex and how your blend of experiences, you know, tactical leader, computer science, how all of that is coming together at a data analytics company?
Yeah, so Complex is a startup software as a service company that's building a data analytics platform. So it's founded by a West Point Rhodes Scholar and another Air Force Academy PhD, you know, one of those really smart guys who went off to grad school in London and got advanced degrees, right? So it's technology based, it's software, and it's about doing data analytics and big data using kind of, you know, what our industrial strength today. And the cybersecurity piece is a use case of that. And so what I do is I've got the business side of it, right? So I was able to find with them the opportunity, right? Because I tell people, right, if you need to code in Fortran and COBOL and the ancient languages of computers, I'm your person. But my coding skills aren't very useful. But I understand, right, the technology, right, because the basics of it haven't changed, right? So I'm able to help on the business side, the finance, the legal, the human resources, the sale, right? All of those things, right? To enable that part, to enable the business, right? So I'm able to kind of integrate the technology side without being the smartest technology person anymore, right? It's just my skill set has atrophied in that area, but I understand the big mega trends and that, but bringing the business side and then the experience of leadership in there. But I also, you know, maintain ties to DOD. So I've recently joined the American Enterprise Institute defense team as a visiting fellow, which enables me to then also sort of continue to contribute on the national security side with resourcing and a lot of the things we've talked about today. And so I'm grateful to AEI for allowing me to kind of start with them and help them help what will now be the new administration and Congress face very difficult decisions for what you do with national security, given multi-trillion dollar deficits, right? So the resourcing becomes very key in the strategic decision making.
Yeah. Well, first, I got to say, you know, huge amount of respect for anyone who can do Fortran. I had to do a project in Fortran in undergrad, and my brain definitely struggled. Sir, thank you so much for being on the show with us today. Do you have any final thoughts or words of wisdom that you'd like to share with the DoD Reads audience?
I guess the theme that runs through all of this is you can learn from your own experiences or you can learn from other people's experiences. And the only way to learn from other people's experiences is either to be curious and go out and ask them and talk to a wide range of people, which is what Brian Glazer advocates, or to read, or both. And so, you know, reading is a way for people to develop experience and skills that they otherwise would learn on their own. The stakes, especially in the military, are way too high to learn things again for the first time. And we have to understand as leaders that we stand on the shoulders of everybody who came before us, and it's our responsibility to learn from them, because the parents out there, the American citizens, are not giving us their money. They care less about the money. They're entrusting us with their sons and daughters and their lives, and they expect us as leaders and your listeners as leaders to do everything humanly possible to take care of the lives of their sons and daughters. And that's a tremendous responsibility. And if you wake up every morning and you start your day thinking about that, it makes everything else during the day easy, because you have a singular focus for what you're doing. And so that's why I thank you, you know, for your emphasis on reading and learning and what you're doing, because, right, if you can make other people out there curious or get other people to read different books, right, that learning becomes cumulative and exponential instead of linear, because, right, we're working at, you know, we're relearning stuff over again.
Thank you, sir. And thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of What Are You Reading? A podcast produced through partnership with DoD Reads. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, subscribe, and share it. Leave us a comment with your answer to the question, What Are You Reading? Also, visit dodreads.com for free books, book reviews, interviews with your favorite authors, and many more free professional development resources. See you next week. Thank you.